www.newsbeat.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration. Accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio, and I'm your host, Asma. I hope you have enjoyed our program up until now. Up next, we have news keeping you updated with the latest headlines. Then we have Radio Productions, delivering another wave of informative content curated just for you by our dedicated team. Next up, the Ocean of Da'a dives deep into spiritual supplications. In this program, we reflect on the rich spiritual heritage of Islamic supplications and ziyarat texts passed down from the Ahlul Bayt as beautifully preserved in Du'a collections like Mafatih al-Jinan. Each episode offers a brief yet meaningful commentary on selected du'as and ziyarat. Following that, another segment of Radio Productions. We've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Discover something new with us. Stay tuned for the news, please.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
International Day of Solidarity with Palestine, Iran's president calls for serious and effective measures by world countries to stop Israel's aggression. Israeli military continues to pound at various locations across Gaza with artillery and airstrikes, breaching a ceasefire agreement with Hamas. And new poll shows U.S. President Donald Trump's approval rating has hit its lowest point over his handling of rising prices and also the fallout from the Epstein files. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. Our top story, Iran's president once again calls for serious and effective international steps to end Israeli aggression and violations against the Palestinian people. Masoud Pezeshkian made the comments in a letter to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The president said the international community has to confront Israel's open violations of international law. Pezeshkian added, ending organized occupation of Palestine and right of return of Palestinian refugees, the only sustainable solution to the Palestinian issue. He further called Israel the most serious threat to world peace and security, saying Iran will continue to offer its absolute support to Palestinians to achieve their objectives. And from Dublin to London and across the Seoul, streets filled with demonstrators rallying in solidarity with Gazans and denouncing Israel's campaign of genocide. Our correspondents have followed a number of these reports for us. Have a look.
They gathered in huge numbers in the Irish capital on Saturday to mark the UN-recognized International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The national march, organized by the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, was backed by more than 170 Irish civil society groups. Protesters are urging the Irish government to finally pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which would prohibit Irish companies from trading with businesses operating inside illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The government made a pledge that they would pass that, and they haven't. And it can't just be about goods, it has to be about services. And the people of Ireland are demanding that. We voted for it, and they're just hiding behind politics.
Campaigners say the so-called ceasefire in Gaza is a fiction, pointing to ongoing Israeli violations and a mounting civilian death toll that adds to the tens of thousands already killed.
I'm opposed to genocide and apartheid. That's why I'm here. I've been marching for 2 years and I'll continue to march.
Humanitarian aid isn't getting in, the medical aid isn't getting in the sort of amounts they need. So it's still pretty desperate, and they're getting into wintertime there. You know, it's cold enough here today, you know, so what's it like if you're living in a tent that's in tatters?
It's a sad day for the world and a sad day for America, a sad day for Britain, sad day for Ireland, that the murder machine of Netanyahu continues.
Yeah, the conditions for people living there are intolerable, and it's not a proper ceasefire, and we're continuing to allow Israel to have people living in apartheid states, and it's not right, and we're right to come out and protest and say it's wrong.
Activists are also calling on the European Union to impose robust sanctions on Israel and to ensure the Netanyahu administration is held accountable in international courts for its crimes against humanity. Because of their complicity and because they're not listening to the electorate, there's a good chance that political parties currently in government right across Europe could be punished when national elections next arise. We've already seen something similar here in Ireland. President Catherine Connolly was elected a landslide victory She was very anti-establishment and very pro-Palestinian. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
With the Israeli regime routinely violating the so-called ceasefire in Gaza and committing atrocities against the Palestinians in the West Bank, the thousands who have descended upon central London today say the importance of expressing solidarity couldn't be overemphasized.
There's no ceasefire. Gaza's still in a terrible state. The West Bank is creeping into an ever and ever worse state. And the media on reporting this, the mainstream media, that's why I'm here. And the least I can do is to be here in a bit of rain when people in Gaza are drowning in their tents in rain.
Organized for the 33rd time, it's a demonstration to also call attention to Britain's ongoing business-as-usual relations with the regime accused of genocide and with its so-called leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
To see Britain and America trashing the international world order in order to support Israel as it commits terrible crimes in Gaza is a matter of deep shame.
To the racists in...
On the stage opposite Downing Street, they may not mention their name, but Palestine Action, the direct action group banned under terrorist laws by the Labour government for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturing sites on UK soil, is on many people's mind. There's also sympathy for the six of the 24 activists jailed by the British government for trying to stop those weapons destined for the Israeli regime.
And I think in any other situation, we would hear about these things. You know, we would hear about hunger strikes if they were connected to Ukraine, maybe, or to Sudan or Congo. There's something about Palestine which means they don't even get their voices heard through the people who are trying to be allies with them here, because they're censored through.
Nearly 50 years ago, the United Nations named today the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, marking Resolution 181 advocating for the partition of Palestine into two states.
And yet another national demonstration terminates outside the halls of power, with the thousands who have gathered here saying they're here to assert that ordinary people in Britain refuse to be silent while their government continues to support a regime that is accused of genocide. Saipur is up, London.
Supporters of Palestine in South Korea joined International Day of Action on Saturday to protest Israel's genocide in Gaza and the West Bank, and to draw attention to the one-sided peace plan of U.S. President Donald Trump.
The closest this peace proposal gets to an acknowledgement of the statehood of Palestine is in small text at the end, stating, "Only after the conditions have been carried out, there may finally be a pathway to Palestinian self-determination." Leaving the freedom of Palestinians not up to their own will, but rather once again in the hands of Israel and the imperialist United States.
The death toll of Palestinians killed by Israel reaches near 70,000 people after 2 years. We're reminded to look past the data.
It's been so long since the current genocide started, and we just see numbers and numbers and numbers, and we forget that these are individuals and these are people and they have families. And we need to remember that, and we need to remember the suffering of other people across the world and how we need to stand up for all of them.
As supporters of Palestine here have emphasized, responsibility for Israel's genocide is widely shared. South Korea continues to deepen ties with Israel, including hosting the Israeli ambassador for public events and expanding military cooperation, including the provision of components for Israeli fighter jets that are still bombing Gaza. Under the cover of a so-called ceasefire, Israel's killed hundreds of Palestinians and has again widened the conflict with deadly bombings of Lebanon and Syria. While now most countries have shifted to support Palestine, more active policies are needed.
Countries need to impose more sanctions, and they need to put more pressure on the country that is aiding Israel.
being the U.S.
Recent winter rains have destroyed thousands of displaced Palestinians' tents. The U.N. demands Israel allow Palestinians to receive much-needed humanitarian and food aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Israel has launched new strikes in different parts of the Gaza Strip since the early hours of Sunday as the regime continues to violate a ceasefire in place in the Palestinian territory since October 10th. Israeli military has reportedly targeted areas in the southern city of Khan Yunis with heavy artillery shelling while warplanes bombed the city of Rafah. Regime forces also attacked two neighborhoods in the eastern Gaza city. In central Gaza, the Israeli army launched airstrikes on Abu Ghraib refugee camp in violation of the ceasefire as well. Now, since October 10th, over 350 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks, with children, women, and the elderly making up a majority of the victims. The Gaza Health Ministry said Saturday the Palestinian death toll surpassed 70,000 since beginning of Israel's genocidal campaign back in late 2023. Now, the United Nations Children's Fund has warned thousands of children under the age of five continue to suffer from acute malnutrition in Gaza despite a ceasefire. According to UNICEF, nearly 9,300 cases of acute malnutrition were recorded in October alone. Agency noted children in the war-torn territory are also suffering from lack of adequate shelter, sanitation, and protection from the winter cold. It stated that high levels of malnutrition continue to endanger the lives and well-being of children in Gaza, warning the situation is getting worse by the onset of winter, which will accelerate spread of disease and increase of risk of death among those most vulnerable. UNICEF said the Gaza needs roughly 300,000 tents and prefabricated housing units to meet the basic shelter needs of Gazans. Robert Enlakesh says the Gaza ceasefire is just designed to give Israel a break while it continues to attack Palestinians and prevent aid from getting into Gaza.
Well, that's the intention behind this so-called ceasefire. It is essentially to give the Israelis a break from their full-scale military campaign. That means a lot of their soldiers, for instance, can go home, or they can be deployed elsewhere in other regions. Of course, now they're threatening Lebanon as well. They can also focus on repairing their tanks. And whilst they do this, they can still bomb the Gaza Strip. They can still shoot civilians and block much-needed aid from coming in, as they are. Now what we're seeing happen is the United States has come in to try and save the Israelis. The United States used six vetoes to pull down resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And of course, there is no repercussions for the United States for doing this. There's no repercussions for the Israelis. In fact, one UN resolution calling for ceasefire did pass because the U.S. Biden administration actually abstained. That was back in 2024 during Ramadan. And it called for a ceasefire until the end of the month. The United States afterwards, they basically apologized to the Israelis and said, yeah, it's a non-binding resolution, which of course anything passed through the Security Council has historically been binding. But this was a green light to the Israelis to continue just doing what they were doing, committing genocide, and nothing came of it. There's no punishment. Even the International Court of Justice, which is the top legal organ of the United Nations, its rulings have meant nothing.
Hamas has categorically condemned Israeli forces escalating raids and abduction of Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, and also slammed Israel for giving extremist settlers a free hand to terrorize Palestinians. Hamas said escalating violations by the Israeli forces and settlers amounts to war crimes, stressing main goal for the regime's incursions to implement West Bank annexation plans, Judaize the entire territory, and displace all of its local residents. Hamas called for urgent action by the international community as well as Arab and Islamic nations to force Israel to stop its crimes and halt continued violations of international law and the rights of the Palestinian people. A senior Hamas official also slammed Israel's escalating violations in the West Bank as part of an official policy to terrorize and displace Palestinian residents. Mahmoud Mardawi described regime's attacks as state-sponsored terrorism carried out under direct political orders from the extremist Israeli regime. New poll shows the U.S. President Donald Trump's approval rating has fallen to its lowest level of his second term. Now, new surveys put the approval of Trump's job performance at just 36%, down 5 points from October, and close to his all-time low of 34% recorded back in 2021. Support dropped across all political groups, including his Republicans. Analysts say the frustration over high prices, domestic deployments of the National Guard to U.S. cities, and U.S. aid to Israel contributed to the decline. Trump's failure to fully release files related to convicted child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein have also thrown off supporters. Venezuela strongly condemned the U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement about closure of the airspace above and surrounding the country. Caracas described Trump's remarks as a colonialist threat against Venezuela's sovereignty and a violation of international law. Venezuelan authorities said such statements constitute hostile, unilateral, and arbitrary act incompatible with the most basic principles of international law. They added Venezuela will continue to fully exercise its sovereignty throughout its airspace. Iran's foreign ministry also slammed Trump's statement as blatant violation of the most basic norms of law and international aviation. Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei described Washington's move as illegal and provocative, warning it poses an unprecedented threat to the safety of international aviation, stressing it also will have serious consequences for the rule of law as well as international peace and security. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Routine is the worst enemy of the human being. It makes us not being able to see the beautiful things that are surrounding us. It makes us not realizing the good things that are happening in our lives. While we continue our sometimes not exciting and so-called modern life, some people come to remind us of the treasures we have and remove the dust of oblivion of the jewels that we keep in the basement of our houses. Lena is a German girl who recently published a book called Behind the Closed Curtains, which reminds us that it is possible to dust off our traditional home elements, remodel them, and give them a modern look, and create a daring, bold, and lively interior design. What Leno has recorded in her book is only a sample of the historical background of using decorations in Iranian interior design and architecture, which is rooted in combination of Iranian culture, religion, and art. And it has evolved as time passes by. As a matter of fact, Iranian houses were a place for development of spirit and physical calmness. There is one thing in common between us and Lena. Lena and her team traveled all over Iran and took their camera behind the closed curtains of Iranian houses. They shot photos and recorded lifestyles, decorations, and designs that are somehow modern, but have roots in our history. Something that was not possible a couple of hundred years ago, but Lena wants to make sure she produces something that can be used as a reference for future generations. Something that shows where and how some Iranians lived in the 21st century.
I was a student of Middle Eastern Studies politics back in Germany, and was learning some Farsi, the Farsi of the books. And I wanted to learn the proper Farsi of the streets and really get to know the country itself. Traveling in Iran, I understood that, okay, there is something in Iran we don't have that way so much. We also have it in Europe, but not in that way, which is handicrafts. So what I understood is like, okay, handicrafts, that's something everyone can relate to because it is interior design, it is decoration. Everyone has a house you have to decorate. So that's where I started. I thought, okay, also in Iran, there will be people who decorate their house and decorate them in a nice way, even if they're probably not interior designers.
What makes Iranian decorative elements more special is that they're timeless. You always find some shining aspects in them, something to fall in love with.
I think it's really cool when you're mixing something from old and bringing it into the modernity. So this is, for example, what Murtaza did here with these henna stones, which are traditionally used to paint the, or you place the feet on it the night before you're getting married, and then you got the henna painted on the feet. So this was the original use, but what Murtaza did, he copied them and use them as basically the feet for a coffee table. It is used outside of the religious context. It's decoration. And I think it is really a beautiful and impressive piece, especially, of course, with all the feathers in this pink, fleshy color, contrasting to the white of the house. In Iranian culture, I mean, there is the flower as a topic is really important. So what we see here is like a lale, actually it's a light, which means also in Persian the flower. And here I think it's really nice the shape you find them throughout Iran. These either candles or nowadays also they work with electricity. But it's a soft shape, so again, it's a curve like in Iranian architecture you find a lot.
Amir Hussein is an Iranian artist inspired by his roots. What is more felt at his house is a daring innovation that definitely comes from a character full of taste and art. What he does is to introduce another usage for the elements of Persian architecture and art, and thus let us see beyond the ordinary and normal elements of our life. A center yard with a pond in the middle, which is surrounded by rooms with different usages during different seasons of the year. At the first glance, you think this is a typical Iranian traditional house. But for sure, it is nothing like my grandparents' house. From what I remember, many decorative and architectural elements are the same, but they're being used very differently. And this creativity is certainly part of the beauty of this house. Is definitely not a piece of cake, especially when you're looking for some very unique items that are infused with Persian culture and our traditions. But remember that there's an artist inside of every one of us. An artist that knows what is beautiful and what is not. An artist that knows how to put things together. But we don't necessarily have the creativity to make these decorative items. And for that reason, people in places like here made our lives easy. You just need to come here and see all these beautiful items. Pick what you love. Make sure that it goes good with your other stuff. And make sure that it fits your personality. Stores like this are the results of a recently started movement by some young Iranians who renovate old houses and decorate them with antique-like and traditional decorative items. I'm very inspired by all these amazing stuff. And looking forward to use them to decorate my own house sometime soon.
I should say this is the happiest day of my life because I published a book on interior design in Iran, and this is the final day, the book presentation. I feel super happy. I am super exhausted too because it has been hard work. I've gone through a lot of ups and downs in the last 8 months, but I feel proud to now say, okay, I published a book, this is the book, and I'm a writer. And I've done something for Iran, a country I really love, and I started with the purpose to show a different Iran to the world, and I think I achieved it.
And Iran is a mysterious land. Every corner of it and every aspect of it is a book with thousands of pages, with beautiful images and amazing stories. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and all of you who are listening to RIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Ocean of Dua. And this program, we try to discuss the different concepts and meanings and try to interpret the passages of different supplications that have been issued by the Ma'sumin, peace be upon them. We were continuing the discussion on the supplication of Sabah, Dua al-Sabah, and let's listen to one passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about that passage.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. اللهم يا من دلع لسان الصباح بنطق تبلجي وسرح قطع الليل المظلم بغياهب تلجلجي وأتقن صنع الفلك الدوار في مقادير تبرجي وشعشع ضياء الشمس بنور تأججي.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to The Ocean of Dua. You just listened to one of the passages of the supplication of Sabah. The Imam says, وَسَرَّحَ قِطَعَ اللَّيْلِ الْمُظْلِمِ بِغَيَاهِبِ تَلَجْلُجِهِ. How does that translate? And dispatched, this is what the translation in front of me is reading. And dispatched the fragments of the dark night into the gloom of its stammering. Okay. Now, before I talk about this passage, it's important that when translating the different supplications, we have to translate as literally as possible. Okay, because if we try to translate semantically and think that this word or this combination or this phrase is trying to say something else other than the literal meaning, the problem is that the words that I have to use are going to be different from the original Arabic. Okay, so we have to translate exactly, faithfully, into the language that we want to understand that Arabic text of the Dua, and then try to see how we can relate each word to another word. So here Allah says, Sarraha, dispatched, he sent forth, he scattered the fragments of the dark night. This is a good translation. It's very literal. Qita al-layl, the fragments of the dark night. Al-layl al-muzlim. Bi-ghayahibi talajluji, into the gloom of its stammering. Talajluji means stammering or stuttering, as in speech, like a person who wants to say something and they keep stammering and stuttering, and they aren't able to express themselves clearly. This is the literal meaning of talajluji. But we have to see what exactly it means to us, because we know that Layl is not a human being that stutters or stammers. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't stammer. It's just that we can't find the relationship physically of the stammering of the night, of the dark night, to the gloom of the dark night. First of all, why fragments? We will talk about why we say fragments after we take a short break. So be with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the all-beneficent, the all-merciful Oh Allah, oh He who extended the morning sun in the speech of its dawning, dispatched the fragments of the dark night into the gloom of its stammering, made firm the structure of the turning spheres in the measure of its display, and beamed forth the brightness of the sun through the light of its blazing.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The Ocean of Dua, Explanation of His Sabah Supplication by Brother Muhammad Reza Piria.
We're continuing our discussion about the second passage of Dua al-Sabah, where Allah says, وَصَرَّحَ قِطَعَ اللَّيْلِ الْمُظْلِمِ بِغَيَاهِبِ كَالَّجُلُجِ. So why fragments? When the sun is setting, we see fragments of darkness, pieces of darkness. It doesn't become dark all of a sudden. It's like it happens piece by piece. This is different from light. When the sun rises, it lights up the whole place, right? But for whenever the sun sets, we see fragments of darkness. For the morning, we see rays of light that extend really far. Okay? But for darkness, which is the absence of light, as we think it is, again, Allah says that He has created a layla wa nahar. We think it's the absence of sunlight. But it's probably something that Allah has created. Just like Allah has created shadows. And we need light to see shadows. Okay, so, and just like when Allah says, خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةَ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا. So this is also something, this is also Allah's creation. Stammering again, because it's, you know, it's the sun is hiding behind the mountains and the sun is setting. And layl, we don't, all of those sounds that we used to hear in the morning, we don't hear them anymore. It's like we have that stuttering of all of those sounds. And that could be one reason that stammering is mentioned in this passage. Again, this is not something 100%. It's something that crosses our minds. Only the ma'asum is capable of interpreting the passage of every dua and verse of the Quran, because they have absolute knowledge and they have knowledge of everything that Allah has given them. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SOAP. I am Bahman Uroy.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for her outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US.
Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I know you must be very tired, but let me just get to the first question. We'll take it from there. What first sparked your interest in activism and political organizing?
I think the first issue that really sparked my interest was the climate crisis, and I quickly realized that we cannot stop the climate crisis without stopping imperialism, and that imperialism is the greatest destroyer of the environment in the world. And I think at first, as a kid in the United States, we aren't taught to care about any country except ourselves. But as my process of getting involved politically developed, I realized the necessity of fighting against U.S.-led imperialism.
Right. And were there formative experiences growing up that shaped your worldview?
Well, I was 12 years old when Donald Trump was elected, and certainly I don't think Donald Trump is an aberration in the long, long history of fascist, genocidal, racist U.S. presidents, but there was a huge spark of political activity and protest and momentum in that moment, and I got involved at a very young age in different movements, whether it was the Women's March, the March for Our Lives against gun violence, and later the 2020 protests against police violence and racism and brutality. And I was involved in many different ways of protesting, of organizing. And as I know we're going to talk about, one of those very formative experiences was working on campaigns and really trying to work within the system like we are told to, and trying to use all these legal means to make change, and realizing over time that politicians don't work for the people, they work for weapons companies and oil companies, and that we need to use other tactics and strategies to make change.
Right. I'm just curious, you were 12-year-old lady when Donald Trump came into office for the very, very first time. So that's such a young age. How would such a young girl get interested even in the politics of these things? You know, what familial background helped you shape that sort of worldview?
Well, I grew up in the United States, but my family is Irish-American. Uh-huh. I've never been to Ireland. My family and my extended family, we aren't very connected to our Irish heritage or background. But once I started to learn about settler colonialism in the U.S. and how this entire American identity, just like the Israeli settler Zionist identity, is a genocidal construct that is built upon the blood of the indigenous peoples of North America, just like the Zionist entity is built upon the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And so connecting to where I'm truly from, where my family is truly from, and learning the fierce, militant history of resistance in Ireland to colonialism, to imperialism, and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, I think gave me a much, much deeper understanding of what struggle means.
Of
and
course.
That it's something that my people have been partaking in for 800 years against colonialism.
So this must have also been kind of a trigger for you to go and study the heritage and the background and what happened with the Irish cause.
Exactly.
That's very interesting, of course. How did your early involvement in climate justice evolve into broader anti-imperialist work?
Like I said, I was part of, a lot of climate organizing, of youth groups such as the Youth Climate Strike, and most of our actions were focused on asking politicians to change their policy. I participated in protests outside the White House, in the halls of Congress, begging our elected officials to listen to us to protect our future. And what I realized is that, asking politely the people in power to, make change that actually works against their own interests when these politicians' campaigns are funded by, all these corporations. And even many of the politicians who claim to be, pro-green energy, sustainability, such as Ed Markey, who I believe we're going to discuss in a bit. Many of them, talk this talk, but in reality, they support the U.S. military, which is the greatest polluter on planet Earth and has caused more environmental destruction and pollution than any other entity on planet Earth. And so what I realized is that imperialism is the primary contradiction in the world today, and that is what we need to focus our struggle on, because it encompasses every single issue. We can't have climate justice, we can't have women's rights, we can't have fair housing and any of the things we want to see while we live in a system of global exploitation and constant war and genocide, which is what the U.S. and Zionist and NATO empire feed off of.
Right. Now I'm going to talk about a little bit about the digital organizing and the youth movements that you were part of. What was it like helping build the Markeyverse and mobilizing Gen Z voters? Tell me about that.
First, let me just say it's crazy to hear that term said on Iranian TV, but that was a big effort.
I did my own work.
It was a big effort that I was involved in. I guess flash forward a couple years after I got involved politically, the COVID pandemic hit. I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school, and suddenly I was stuck at home and locked inside. And so all of the organizing that I was doing shifted to the digital sphere, and a lot of adults and folks, working in political organizations and campaigns didn't know how to use the tools of social media to mobilize young people in the way that young people who are just fluent in these platforms do. And we innovated really creative techniques to turn out young voters. And we really emphasized, the candidate that we were supporting, Ed Markey, his stance on the Green New Deal, on progressive legislation that we supported. But in retrospect, a lot of that legislation, it was simply to improve the lives of people living in the U.S. And that is predicated upon the continuation of the, exploitation of the global South, the continuation of these wars and these genocides. And I still learned a lot from those experiences. I've arrived at the politics I have today by trying all these different tactics and strategies and realizing, what is futile versus what actually poses a threat to the ruling class and to our oppressors.
Right. And how do you see digital activism changing the landscape of political engagement?
To borrow a phrase from Fidel Castro, I think the battle of ideas is being waged on social media. And so we cannot write off the digital sphere, we cannot write off these platforms as important battlegrounds for us to wage ideological struggle, to counter imperialist propaganda. If we look at how, the CIA and various imperialist agencies' investments and strategies and budgets have shifted over the past decades, increasingly so much is being invested on propagandizing through the digital sphere. You know, I think some really good examples are the regime change attempts in Cuba and in Iran, which attempt to portray themselves as, you know, organic, homegrown protest movements, but in reality are usually hashtags that were created in Washington, D.C. or Langley, Virginia. And that's why I'm so honored to be here, because what I do have is a platform where I can, you know, share the reality that I'm seeing. And while I don't claim to be an expert on anything, really, I do think that, you know, having young people from the United States see this reality and see, you know, the destruction of that is caused by the U.S. Zionist aggression, and to bring back those lessons to people in the U.S. to understand is absolutely essential.
Well, you know, Carla, we are living in a world with mainstream media having the final say in many, many of the events that we are surrounded by. How do you make yourself heard by the people around you while they are also all being bombarded by these mainstream media regarding the truth that you have uncovered?
I think that's another, you know, change that's been caused by the shift to digital platforms and social media is, although mainstream media is dominant in many ways, social media kind of democratizes how we receive news. And so regular people, yes, despite, you know, not working for the BBC or CNN or MSNBC, we can create a platform for ourselves. And I think often that is so much more compelling to our audience and to people who want to understand what is happening in the world, because frankly, mainstream media is very dishonest. And I think the average person is smart enough to realize that and to be disillusioned with it. And the fact is they ignore, you know, the vast majority of what is actually happening in the world. And so to create our own platforms and to elevate our own voices, and to speak the truth and without fear of being critical of power and of capital and of the imperialist ruling class is a great task, but I think it is one that we are seeing great progress on, and that consciousness is greatly shifting, yeah, especially among young people. And that is why the U.S. is trying to crack down on platforms like TikTok. That is why there is so much increasing censorship on platforms like Meta. I, of course, have been suspended many times on these platforms. But nevertheless, we have to continue to get our word out there. And we also need to be creative with how we disseminate ideas, because yeah, increasingly, the censorship is only going to get worse, and we can't only be reliant on, you know, platforms that are controlled by our enemy.
Tell me something. I think within the American scene and the issue of censorship, I think it's getting harder and harder to get a message across. Do you think it's always been like that, or it has become visibly worse? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. You know, I think freedom of speech has always been a lie. It's freedom of speech for those who the government feels
almost
like it.
Almost everywhere.
Yes, but I do think we've seen some qualitative escalations and crackdowns in both the U.S. and in the so-called United Kingdom and in Europe. Yeah. I would point to, you know, the prescription of Palestine action in the U.K. Right. as a really extreme example, and you know, our comrades there, they can't even say the words Palestine action without potentially being charged with terrorism. And in the United States, you know, it's not quite there yet, but we are seeing so many people being fired from their workplaces, being kicked out of their universities for mere anti-Zionist speech. You know, the sacrifice of losing a job or losing a degree is minuscule compared to what Palestinians are sacrificing, compared to what Iranians are sacrificing, compared to what, you know, the people in the entire global South, and especially the Axis of Resistance countries, are experiencing under U.S. Zionist imperialism. And so, in my view, the best way to respond to the censorship is to double down and to be louder than ever, because the louder that we are, the harder it is for them to silence us. And they actually can't possibly, you know, repress us all if we are all speaking out in support of the Palestinian resistance. And so while I expect for there to be more, for there to be more lawfare, for there to be more attempts to crush free speech, nevertheless, I think we have to, you know, double down on our pro-resistance speech. And, you know, I wanna shout out especially the organization Samidun, which was designated in Canada and the U.S., and there were restrictions placed on it because they support the Palestinian resistance and because they fight for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. And there was a lot of fear that was instilled in people in the movement that if they even say, you know, I stand by Samidun because of this, during this, you know, phony designation, there's a lot of fear that that could, you know, even lead to people being targeted. But if we all stand together and if we all, you know, stand in solidarity with people facing repression, it is impossible for them to be isolated. So, yes, I think it's important to use these moments of the intensified repression to build more unity in our principles of resistance and steadfastness.
Right. And after working on, well, of course, you worked on Senator Markey's campaign. What led you to your disenchantment with electoral politics?
I'd certainly been, you know, slowly getting disenchanted over time. I think my values and my principles were always far more radical than what could be expressed in an electoral campaign. But those were the opportunities that I found to get involved in change. And I realized, especially after taking part in protests in 2020, and then especially after what happened in Palestine in May 2021, the evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, the Six-Day War, and the bombardment of Gaza, that woke me up to the reality of imperialism and of the Zionist genocide against Palestine. And what I can only understand is my own complicity in that up until the moment that I broke with the U.S. states and working within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is, you know, just as genocidal and imperialist as the Republican Party. They just have different tactics and strategies through which they hold on to power. And like I said, I, you know, had worked for the senator, I'd worked for many politicians, and just seeing, you know, how horrific the bombardment was, and also how heroic the Palestinian response, the response of the resistance in Gaza was, firing back at the Zionist entity, I realized it was a moment where I had to make a choice that would define the trajectory for the rest of my life, which was to split with this liberal, reformist, social imperialist part of the, you know, movement that I was in, and to self-criticize, to use that as an opportunity to bring more people over to being pro-Palestine, to being anti-Zionist. We started a pressure campaign on the senator to try to get him to change his stance. And the failure of that to get him to change his stance also made me realize that even though that was someone I'd worked for and invested my labor in and helped him win the election, that my voice made no difference compared to checks from AIPAC or checks from Zionist donors or from weapons companies or his investment in U.S. interests. And so after that, I became much more involved in the pro-Palestine movement, and I basically completely left electoral politics, and from there on out spoke very vocally about how I feel like electoralism is ultimately, you know, counterinsurgent, and that we need to make a firm, clean break and to work outside of these institutions to, you know, create something new, to build an alternative to empire.
Right. And of course, you were involved with politics for a while. Did you find different voices? Like, for example, what we hear from Senator Bernie Sanders. Did you see that sort of voices often within the politics, within the mechanics and the machination of the mechanics of politics in the U.S.? Such voices, are they just rare, Well, there are still more than just one person in there thinking the way he does.
I think that I see, you know, I see Bernie Sanders, I see Ed Markey, I see AOC and the squad. Even, you know, Zohran Mamdani, who just won this election in New York.